Douglas Crook, Wednesday, January 16th, 2013.
Last week we left off in chapter 6 of the book of Job. So if you'll turn with me this evening, we'll pick up where we left off in the 15th verse of the 6th chapter of the book of Job. Job is in the midst of responding to his first friend's criticisms and accusations and innuendos that Job is suffering because he sinned, because in the estimation of his friend Eliphaz, and actually in his other friends are going to echo the same sentiments, the same false doctrine, that God never allows the righteous to suffer, and he only punishes and causes to suffer the wicked. And so that's the accusation. Job, my friend, you're suffering, and suffering as few men have ever suffered, so you must be one of the worst sinners on the planet. So he's responding to that, and in verse 15, he continues his response, and he says, "My brothers have dealt deceitfully like a brook, like the streams of the brooks that pass away, which are dark because of the ice and into which the snow vanishes. When it is warm, they cease to flow. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. The paths of their way turn aside. They go nowhere and perish. The caravans of Tema look, the travelers of Sheba hope for them. They are disappointed because they were confident. They come there and are confused. For now you are nothing. You see terror and are afraid." In this passage, Job is simply expressing his disappointment in his friends at their accusations and their lack of compassion for him and for his situation. He was hoping to get some comfort from them when he saw them come, and when they spent a week in mourning with him, he was hoping that he would kind of receive some sound counsel from them and encouragement. But instead, they only added to his pain that he was already suffering. They added to his confusion. What's this about? I thought you were my friends. And to express all of that, to illustrate all of that, he says, "You're like the rivers that form from the melting snow, that form these little rivers in the trade passages of that were known in Job's time and Job's territory. And these streams would form when the snows began to melt and some nice cool water that people were expecting to find when they came there. The only problem is that in the midst of summer, when it was the hottest and water was the most, when it was most necessary to find water, those streams would dry up. And so people that were traveling and expecting to find water in those streams, when they arrived, they were pretty disappointed. I mean, it was a serious disappointment. It could actually, you could die if you didn't find water elsewhere. And so Job's situation and his disappointment is this dire, in because his friends have miserably failed him. Verse 22, "Did I ever say, 'Bring something to me,' or offer a bribe for me from my wealth, or deliver me from the enemy's hand, or redeem me from the hand of oppressors?" Job is simply reminding his friends that, "I've never asked anything of you. What I expected of you now, it wasn't unreasonable. I just wanted some comfort and some encouragement from you. And I've never asked anything else from you. This isn't too much to ask of our friendship." Verse 24, "Teach me, and I will hold my tongue." Remember, they are upset because he was so discouraged that he just wanted to die, and they didn't think that he should utter such words. And he says, "Teach me, I will hold my tongue. Cause me to understand wherein I have erred. How forceful are right words, but what does your arguing prove? Do you intend to rebuke my words in the speeches of a desperate one, which are as wind? Yes, you overwhelm," and the word means to set a net for. You overwhelm the fatherless, and you undermine your friend. Job is now demanding that they present evidence of their accusations against him. He sinned, they said. You're a sinner. He says, okay, if I'm a sinner, present the evidence. I know it would be tough for me to hear, but if I've sinned, I need to know, and I want to know. He was willing to hear tough words as long as they were true and as long as there was proof that he had actually failed God in some way, that he had dishonored God. But instead, he says they treated Job's words and the evidence that Job presented of his integrity, they treated it as hot air, the wind. You're not hearing me. I'm saying that I know of nothing. There's no unconfessed sin in my life that I'm aware of. And if you're saying otherwise, please present the evidence. I'd love to hear it. Their treatment of their friend has been as unjust and as immoral in Job's eyes as someone who mistreats an orphan. And you can't stoop any lower than that, than to take advantage of an orphan or anyone that has no protection or recourse. Job is sitting in the city dump in pain, can't sleep, can't eat, can't rest. And now they come and they continue to add to his pain. They were treating him in a way that was not only right, it was immoral. We need to take heed to the lessons that we can learn today. This is an account of a man who suffered things that many of us will not suffer to the degree that he suffered. We'll find out that we probably all have been tempted to some of his doubts, to some of his confusions, to some of his pain and sorrow, but I doubt any of us would claim to have suffered to the degree that Job has. But there are things that we can learn from these things, and one thing that Job is insisting on from his friends. He says, you're accusing me, you're coming to certain conclusions about me because you are looking at the circumstances, and I'm suffering, and you believe it is your doctrine that only the wicked suffer. And so I'm suffering. Circumstance shows that I'm suffering, so I must be a sinner. You've come to conclusions. He said, all I'm asking you to do is before you judge me, present the facts. And this is something that I think all of us can learn from. Let's go to John 7:24. So we understand these are principles that transcend dispensational lines. Jesus gave us some words that we need to heed and to take seriously when we are dealing with our brothers and sisters, especially, and really with anyone, but especially as we come to the family of God. John 7 and verse 24. Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. This principle, this truth, is something we should apply to every relationship. We are so quick to judge one another and to judge situations based on only what we see. And oftentimes, those conclusions are wrong. Jesus, at the time that he stated this, he was being accused of having a demon. That's what it looked like to the religious leaders. This man is saying things that he shouldn't say. He was doing things that they didn't think he ought to be doing, like healing on the Sabbath and doing those kinds of things. And so according to their circumstance, this is what I know based on my experience. And this is what the circumstance says, so this must be the conclusion. Jesus has a demon. And you see, of course, how far off base that judgment was. But many times we misjudge one another as well. And so we need to be careful. Before we make serious accusations against anyone, before we make conclusions about our brothers and sisters, let's make sure we have the facts straight. Let's hear the facts. Let's know the evidence. And then we can act according to the instruction of God based on what the actual circumstances are. what the facts are. There are times when we will have to act. There are times when our brothers and sisters do fail. But there is a course of action. There is a righteous judgment. And all that simply means is that we judge and we act according to what is right in the sight of God, what is right according to His instruction. But if we just do what we think ought to be done, if we just come to conclusions because this is what it looks like, then that's not right in God's sight. That's not righteous judgment. This is all that Job was asking of his friends. He says, I can hear the tough words. If I have failed and you know that I've failed, then please tell me. But if not, stop accusing me. Stop the false accusation. Verse 28 of Job. Verse 6, or chapter 6 rather. Job 6:28. Now therefore, be pleased to look at me. It appears that his friends could no longer even look at him because he was so disfigured. Now therefore, be pleased to look at me, for I would never lie to your face. Yield now, let there be no injustice. Yes, concede, my righteousness still stands. Is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my taste discern the unsavory? Kind of like the paraphrase from the Message on this passage. It says, look me in the eyes. Do you think I'd lie to your face? Think it over. No double talk. Think carefully. My integrity is on the line. Can you detect anything false in what I say? Don't you trust me to discern good from evil? So Job again is insisting that he knows of no unconfessed sin in his life. Now, make no mistake about it, as we had in our opening lessons, Job is not claiming to be sinless. He's simply saying, I know of no unconfessed sin in my life. He knows of nothing that he's done or said that would merit his suffering as punishment for that. And this, of course, is God's testimony of him. He is blameless. Again, not sinless, but he is blameless. He's done what I've asked him to do. He's applied my remedies of grace where necessary. When he has failed, when his family has failed, he's offered the proper sacrifices. He's done what I've asked him to do. He's done what is right in my sight. And so Job is begging his friends. He looked to them for some help, some comfort, some encouragement. And he's simply saying to them, if you have evidence to the contrary, if you have evidence that I am, that my integrity is not intact, then please produce it and stop talking to me. Stop accusing me falsely. Now in chapter 7, we need to give a little preparation before we get into it. Before we read Job's words in this 7th chapter, it's important for us to remember, not only when we're looking at Job, but any of the Old Testament characters, we need to remember that God has always dealt with his people according to the revelation of himself and of his will that he has given them. God never judged an individual for what they didn't know about him, for what he had not yet revealed to them. Now, Job lived in a time when God's revelation to man was in pretty much in its infancy. The law of Moses had not even been given yet. And we need to remember that when we hear Job utter some things, that if you and I were to utter these things in this church age when we've been given the full revelation of the grace of God, they would be words of unbelief, and that, of course, would be sin for us to utter with what we know about God. But Job didn't know the things that we know. And so God did not hold him accountable for what he did not yet know. He's not accountable for, God didn't treat Job like he now deals with us. To whom much is given, much is required. Jesus taught that. Now Job knew that God was God. There are some things Job did know. And honestly, in the infancy of the revelation of God to man, Job knew a tremendous amount about God. He knew far more about God than his friends did. And God himself makes that statement before we're done. But Job knew that God was God and that he was worthy of our worship and devotion and obedience. And nothing changes in Job's faith concerning those truths. Job knew God was sovereign. Job knew that his life was in God's hands. Again, something that even Christians today don't lay hold of. But Job knew that, and he never wavered from that. His life was in God's hands. But he also knew that God could do with him whatever he wanted. He was God's creature. Now, what Job did not yet understand and had not yet been revealed to him, but was going to be revealed to him in a measure, is that God deals with those who trust him with an eternal purpose, not just a momentary purpose. And this is something that he had not yet fully revealed to man, but he was about to reveal to Job that why he was suffering was in order to prove that Job's faith was genuine and worthy of the reward of God's grace. That worthiness of faith, that genuine faith, brought glory to God. Remember Satan's accusations. Well, the only reason he worships you is because you treat him so well. And God said, that's not true. His faith is genuine. And here's the proof. God was about to reveal to Job more about his own love and care for him, for Job. He was bringing Job into a closer fellowship with himself, and he did it through Job's suffering. But Job didn't know all of that. He didn't have all the prior examples to look to that we have. He didn't have, for example, even Abraham. Abraham might not have been too far away from Job, but Job didn't know that God tested Abraham's faith and told Abraham to kill his only son. The one that God says, this is the one that all the promises I made you, they're going to be fulfilled in Isaac. Kill him. Now, why would God do that? The same reason he's allowed Job to suffer. To test Job. Not for God to see, I wonder what he's going to do. But so Job and Abraham and all of God's people that are tested, to show to ourselves, first of all, whether or not our faith is genuine, and then also to glorify his own work of grace in us by showing that our faith in his grace is genuine. So Job's going to say some things that may shock you. They certainly shocked his friends. And if we would say these things, if I would say these things in the midst of my suffering, I would be accountable, because I know some things Job didn't know. We know in this church age that God doesn't abandon his people and he doesn't torture them for fun. Job is going to, in the next several speeches, he's actually going to present the question, God, are you sadistic? Why would you create me and then torture me? This is how low he's gotten. But I know from looking at Job's experience, which Job didn't have the end results yet, but I can look at Job's life, I can look at Abraham, I can look at Joseph, I can look at all the Old Testament saints, I can come to the New Testament, I can go through all the church age, and I understand that God said he would never leave me nor forsake me. Romans 8:28, Job didn't have, I have. I know that all things work together for my good and for God's glory. The Apostle Paul wrote, he said, all things are yours. That means they exist, they happen for your benefit. Peter tells us the trial of our faith is more precious than gold. Job is going to learn that, and his faith even expresses an understanding that that is probably what God is doing. But before it's all said and done, he's going to know it for a certainty. You and I should know it now. The suffering of this present time is not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. Job didn't have that hope, not as fully as you and I have it. Paul said that light afflictions, they're working for us, not against us, but for us, a far greater measurement of glory. Now, if Job had understood all of these things and had these promises, which he didn't, it would have given him an anchor and it would have warded off a lot of the confusion that we're going to read that he expressed to his friends. Let's be careful when we judge Job. Let's judge him with the same standard with which God judged him. And if we do that, then we'll learn the lessons that we need to learn. Job 7, beginning at verse 1. Is there not a time of hard service for a man on earth? In the Hebrew, it seems to be a reference to military service. And in other words, an enlisted soldier. A soldier has a time of hard service. Are not his days also like the days of a hired man? Like a servant who earnestly desires the shade, and like a hired man who eagerly looks for his wages? So I have been allotted months of futility. Job has suffered for months. We don't know how long. But this is dragging on and on and on. And wearisome nights have been appointed to me. When I lay down, I say, when shall I arise? You ever have one of those nights? He had months of these nights. You lay down to get some rest, and you end up being more restless. Oh, when's morning so I can get out of bed? I'm hurting. My mind is just going. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? And the night be ended. For I have had my fill of tossing till dawn. My flesh is caked with worms and dust. My skin is cracked and breaks out afresh. In this passage, Job is acknowledging. He says, I know. Many people have hard lives. He's trying to express, I'm not whining unnecessarily. Do you understand what I've gone through and how long I've had to endure this? He says, an enlisted soldier, I know, he has a hard service for a time, but at least he has the hope that when his time's up, he can go home. A laborer or a slave, they work hard all day. I understand that other people have hard lives, but at least they can go at the end of the day and sit under the shade and find rest and get some comfort. A hired hand, he works hard. I understand that. But at the end of the day, at least he has the reward of his wages. They have the hope of release and comfort and rest and reward at the end of their toil. He says, I don't see an end here. Why am I suffering so? There's no end in sight for him. There's no rest. There's no comfort. There's no shade tree at the end of this for him that he can see. He's in constant pain. And this is not an exaggeration, talking about his festering, infected sores. He gets no rest at night. So where's the hope of his relief? Now Job, in verse 6, he turns to address God. And the things that he says to God, you and I should never say in the light of the truth that we have. But even in what Job expresses here, I want you to notice that he never curses God like Satan says he would. Satan was wrong. God was right. Job, in all of his pain and despair and confusion, he never curses God, or he never denies God that he's God, or he never says that he's going to stop worshiping him as God. He doesn't say, God, if you don't deliver me, I'm done with you. Never says that. He's simply asking God, why? It seems unfair what you're doing. And yet, even in that confusion, his faith and his integrity still is intact. Again, in the light of what he knew, in the light of the truth that he had, his faith was still intact. He still goes to God with his problem. He's still calling upon God. He's not looking anywhere else, and the friends that should have been there to help support him and been God's instruments to support him, they failed him. So God is his only recourse, and he never stops going to God. And this is something that, again, you and I can learn from Job. When we're in the midst of sorrow and suffering, and when we have questions and when we're confused, too many times I've seen it over and over and over again, when God's people are hurting, some of the first things they do is they stop praying. They stop reading their Bible. They stop assembling themselves together. They stop serving others. They stop doing all of the things that is going to be the only source of strength and direction and comfort and encouragement. But in Job's life, with the little light that he had, he keeps going to God. We need to remember that. Verse 6, now he's addressing God. He says, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. I don't know how fast that is, but apparently it's pretty fast. I guess we could use the modern example, as fast as a sewing bobbin. Is that right? Is that right language? That little spinning thing on the sewing machine and goes up and down and around, that's fast. My days are swift like that and are spent without hope. Oh, remember that my life is a breath. Remember, he's talking to God here. My eye will never again see good. The eye of him who sees me will see me no more. While your eyes are upon me, I shall no longer be. As the cloud disappears and vanishes away, so he who goes down to the grave does not come up. He shall never return to his house, nor shall his place know him any more. Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Job knows his words are harsh. But he says, I see no end here. I see no hope. And he feels that he needs to remind God about the brevity of his life here on earth. Job was soon going to die a miserable death. And he says, God, you'll no longer see me. His thought is that Job would no longer be among the living who served and honored God. And since Job's life was so short, he's asking God, why are you making me spend this short life of mine in such misery? I don't understand it. And he felt he had a right to complain to God. And remember, before you judge him, try to put yourself in his skin. All the emotional loss of the loss of family and wealth and position, and then this unimaginable daily pain of these festered sores that are infected and literally worms, bleeding, can't eat, can't sleep. He says, my life is brief and this is how I'm going to live it. Verse 12. Am I a sea or a sea serpent that you set a guard over me? Interesting words, and this could have one or two references. The understanding of his analogy is clear, but it could be a reference to a familiar myth. Job refers to several familiar myths of his day to try to paint a picture. He's not giving any credibility to the myths. He's simply using them to illustrate his condition. But it could refer to a myth about a mythical god who captured a wild mythical monster and tamed it, or at least controlled it. Or it could simply be a reference to the raging sea and the sea creatures that in and of themselves have a nature that's uncontrollable, but are in the control of God. God controls the sea, no matter how wild they may be. But either way, what Job is saying, he's saying to God, I know you're controlling my circumstances. I know you've allowed my suffering. But why? Why have you been so harsh with me? Am I a vicious sea monster? Am I a vicious sea that you have to treat me so harshly to control me, to contain me? Again, harsh words. You and I should never speak those words knowing that we are the children of the Most High God. But can you see where in Job's situation with the light that he had, it really wasn't out of line for Job. He just didn't know. Verse 13, when I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint. Oh, I could just lay down a little bit, I'll be all right. And then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that my soul chooses strangling and death rather than my body. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are but a breath. It seems to Job that God is just constantly pursuing him and thinking up new ways to torture him. That's how it feels to Job. Job would prefer to die of suffocation, which he expresses he's having trouble breathing anyway. Just let me die of suffocation than to spend the rest of my very short life being hounded by God. Verse 17, what is man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him, that you should visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my saliva? That was a familiar saying in that day, just to say, will you leave me alone for a second? So, mothers, you might try this on your children someday. Will you let me alone till I swallow my saliva? It might get their attention for a second. But that's what he's saying. God, will you just look away for a second? It reminds me, if it wasn't so serious for Job, it would almost be humorous. I've made reference to it. Brother Freestone's made reference to the character Tevye in the movie? Fiddler on the Roof. When he says, God, I know we're the chosen people, but just for once, could you choose somebody else? That's kind of what Job's saying here. Why are you so interested in me? Won't you just leave me alone? He doesn't understand. Why would the Almighty be so interested in Job's life and wants him just to look away? Now, Job was soon to have a better understanding. He was going to understand what God's real interest was in Job. Right now, Job doesn't understand. And again, he had no foundation, no example to understand why God was so interested in him. Job thought, God's trying to destroy me, and I don't know why. But he was about to learn that God had an eternal interest in Job's life. He had chosen Job to come to know God like no man in Job's world had ever known God. And to stop and think about that a speck of dust was about to be let in on the counsel of the Almighty God. What a privilege Job was about to receive. He didn't know it yet, but he was soon to change the thought there. What is man? Why do you keep picking on me? He was about to understand what David understood in Psalm 8. Let's turn to the 8th Psalm, where we have similar words, but with a whole different understanding. Job's was, why are you so interested in me that you all the time are picking on me? But here the psalmist David had a different revelation, and Job was about to have it. Psalm 8, and we'll have to close with this. Yeah, I think we better. Job 8, 1 through 9. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, who have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and nursing infants you have ordained strength because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. When I consider your heavens and the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained. Now, Job is going to also talk about the majesty and the creative power and the wisdom of God. So he had that same revelation. But this is how David presents it in verse 4. What is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? But David's thought was not to visit him to torture him, but to bless him, to protect him, to reveal yourself to him. Verse 5, for you have made him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, even the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and the fish of the sea that pass through the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. David understood the mercy and the grace of God that would bring such blessing and revelation to such a lowly creature as man. David was glad that God looked at us and blessed us, but he didn't understand why. Job wasn't quite there yet when he uttered the words that we've read, but he's going to get there. Well, I think we'll close there tonight. I'm glad that we live in this age of grace. I'm glad for the revelation of the love and the mercy and the grace of God. Let's stand. We'll be dismissed.